I'll just say that I did a terrible, unprofessional job of identifying where these poems came from. A good scholar would be very careful to mention that the first two of the poems come from her book Abacus. The next two or three come from The Devil's Tour. The next few come from Viper Rum. And then the last two, I think, are from Sinner's Welcome. We'll look at these a little later on. I come to this subject out of several decades-long interest in something that I haven't heard anybody else talk about, and so I'm hoping that I'm going to hide this for Mary Carr thing. Yeah. I come to this. When I did my MFA in poetry at Vermont College, I did my thesis on something I called at that time the poetry of conversion. I had found that as a writer, a young writer, there are lots of Christians in the canon. You know, you can find them, and that's fine. But there aren't many that I didn't know of any, really, who were contemporary, spoke in the idiom of the now, and who weren't afraid of the crazy babble that we live in, with mixed dictions all over the place. I think it's one reason why I love Mary Carr's work, is she understands the mixed diction of our context. I mean, we're just talking like Anglo-Saxon. We're talking mixed speak, and it's all kind of blending together. And it's wild. Anyway, so I was on Martha's Vineyard. If you're familiar with Book Den East. It's a used bookstore, pre-owned bookstore, and I was in the poetry section. I pulled out a little volume because I like John Berryman. Before I was converted, I liked him because his poems were like drunken rants, and I could kind of enjoy the elastic relationship with reality, and also the brilliance sort of transecting that. In this book, his book, Love and Fame, which most critics think is pretty terrible. Come on in, if somebody wants in. Thanks, Dave. Love and Fame, the first two-thirds of Love and Fame is him, is Berryman talking about all these sort of gross indiscretions that he has launched himself into with the help of alcohol and a super sex drive. And it was said of Berryman that none of his friends had to do anything crazy. They could just live their craziness through his decisions to be absolutely out of his mind. At the end of Love and Fame, if you're familiar with sort of the work of John Berryman, there's this little crazy section called 11 Addresses to the Lord. And as you're going through this admittedly sort of low Berryman, suddenly you hit this odd little section. And in it, he confesses that he came to the end of his rope. He ended up committing suicide, jumping off a bridge in Minneapolis. But before the darkness got the better of him at that point, on that day, he returned to God. He returned his life to God. His friends made fun of it. They said, "Oh, that's just the pose. He's just trying to make. He's just trying to write a different kind of poetry." But reading those poems, I discovered someone who had lived famously a debauched existence, who found God in his heart and his mind, his imagination. He was trying to get into the new life that he felt he was being called to. The dark disciplines of his life sort of finally got the better of him. But that find in Book Denis got me interested in pursuing this idea of a literature of conversion in a modern context. And of course, you might be able to think of other people who sort of famously have converted in popular culture. Someone like Bob Dylan, Denise Levertov, if you know her story. There are others I'm not good at remembering on the spot. I did not know Mary Carr. I don't read a lot of prose. I'm that guy that went through high school and college reading the first and last pages of everything and then something in the middle and then writing an essay. So reading has always come hard to me. Poems are a good size. You can enter it in 15, if it's long, 15 minutes later be done with it. Writing poems also became a source of great pleasure for me because, again, you could begin it and you could sort of complete the draft in a very short period of time and put it aside and then come back to it as you had energy for as long as you wanted. And so I love the process of revision as well. And so it was a pleasure to discover Mary Oliver, who is sort of now famous for her conversion, but I didn't know that. What I want to do is Berryman led me to, is rethinking of okay, what happens in an artist's life when they move from worldview A to worldview B. My interest is in Christian conversion, but it could be from Buddhism to Scientology. There's going to be these sorts of huge sea changes occur all around. So this could be applied outside of the realm of Christian thinking just as easily. I think it could be applied to what we're going to look at today. I was not a literature major, as you could probably guess from how I described how I read. I studied sociology and loved it. And then I went to seminary and did an MDiv and worked in the Episcopal Church for 25 years. And now I'm a counselor and teacher at a boarding school. I have been there for 25 years. So this is what I want to do. I remembered, after having read these poems by Berryman, I remembered this little book that that we sociologists read, Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn. And familiar with it? Anybody familiar with that book? It was an incredibly seminal book back in the 60s. And in it, I mean, he was trying to do a sort of a historian's approach to science and trying to explain why we're no longer Copernicans, and now we're post-Einsteinians. And so he looked at the history of science and posited a theory of worldview change. And there are five little stages that he posited. He didn't call them worldview. He talked about scientific paradigms. So you begin with paradigm A, which is the way all scientists look at the world, and within that way of looking at the world, there are given procedures, ways of doing science, and so it's not only a way of seeing the world, it's also a way of doing the world as a scientist. But with any paradigm, any human paradigm of the universe, we don't see the whole thing. Hate to break it to you. You know that, I know that. And no human being has ever seen the whole thing. So, if we're honest about the paradigm we live with, there's going to be some insecurity. We can't connect all the dots. And there are some dots that are so random and so inexplicable that we want to sweep them under the rug. They're called anomalies. Kuhn calls them anomalies. They just cannot be figured into the way we think and the way we do the world. And that's, anomalies are fine if they don't proliferate. But if you're really doing good science and looking more and more carefully at the universe, you're going to discover more and more anomalies. Things don't fit your way of seeing the way things are. And that provokes a crisis within the scientific community. Enough people realize that their way of seeing the world is wrong or inadequate, and they really begin to panic. What's going to happen? We're wrong, folks. We are wrong. And some start to announce the fact that we're wrong and we need another way of seeing the world. And they're kind of moving through the anomalies and they begin to look for the alternatives. If we're wrong, then what's more right? But a lot of people get to the point of crisis and they just double back. They cannot cope. Their entire careers are invested in one way of seeing the world, one way of doing the world. And so they hit that crisis and they bounce back, they become reactionaries. They may still do good science in their little area, but they're no longer interested in accounting for what they can't explain. For those who have the capacity for uncertainty, the bearing uncertainty and working within a rather chaotic moment of science, there's an openness to what else, how else, tell me, how else could we explain this? You know, let's have a group of people sit down. You do your thinking, I'll do my thinking, and then let's bring our thinking to the table and let's just rip and tear each other apart because we do not want to come up with something that's less solid than A. We want to come up with something that's more solid. We need a new paradigm for how to do science, how to think about the universe and do science. It does get political. And economics come into play, and brilliant people are shat upon politically and economically, and some great ideas never actually get seriously considered. And often the paradigm that often this paradigm isn't the best one. It's just the one that has the most backing of the scientific community and the most research money behind it. I mean, we live in a very practical world, and the scientists do the same. The honest ones know that, okay, we've gotten to B, but that doesn't resolve for a whole host of anomalies that persist. And so science moves on, and it does its work looking at the world differently and engaging the universe slightly differently, but it moves on, anticipating crisis, anticipating this sort of revolutionary progress. And issues of loyalty and allegiance come up. I mean, it's huge. Both interpersonal loyalties and allegiances, and then also allegiances to truth. In any case, reading Berryman, I remembered this, and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to play with Kuhn's concept of change in the scientific community and apply that within the realm of the arts? But on a personal level. And so rather than it be paradigm A, paradigm B, we're talking about worldview, religious commitment, cosmological loyalty, allegiance, or whatever, and what happens when things start to break down. And even our theologies our tightest theologies are weak. They're human constructs, and they will fail us because they're human constructs, and they do not account for all the mystery and all the random chaos of the cosmos and our lives. And so hopefully we're not always just looping back to name your favorite theologian, but we're, with Christ, we're pressing forward with the Word, with sort of the things that we hold as authoritative spiritually. We look also for ways of accounting for the world we live in that are more satisfying than the in-house bickering that we had in the Reformation between the Counter-Reformation and the German Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, and all that morass of ugliness, human ugliness, coming to bear in the name of Jesus. Maybe there's a better way to see the mission of Christ in the world. So I also leaned a little on Jim Sire. You familiar with his book, The Universe Next Door? A really terrific book that introduces some worldview questions that many worldviews don't want to deal with. But it's a very useful book. Asking questions of what is prime reality, identity, who am I, who are we, purpose, what's wrong and how do we fix it? There's no H in what, that's what's wrong. It's too small for you to notice. I was going to be funny. The meaning of history, what is it, what happens after death, what's our ultimate destination, and how do we know what we know, the epistemological question. Great questions. When the crisis hits and we're really making a move, and I don't know how many of you grew up in a Christian home, how many of you are converts. I'm a convert. So when my world started to crash in, I experienced anomalies rather viscerally. And I tried to medicate because the pain was so great. These questions, every one of these questions comes into play in the process of having a worldview collapse. And likewise, as you begin looking for the alternatives, of course, if we're seeking, there's that whole thing of, if you seek me, you'll find me, but we know that we don't actually find God, he finds us, and there's all, but it's, anyway, as we press through this crisis and we begin to explore Eastern mysticism, we begin to explore the sayings of Jesus, we begin to, or the magisterium of the church, we just begin meditation, yoga. What else? How else to live in the world and to think about my life and the meaning and ultimate, what happens after death? All those questions come into play, and we, in our own way, in our own time, try to find the new answers for ourselves. Sad that some people get here, they're open to Christ, and their experience of the church is so crappy that they double back, they bail, because they're running into perhaps some, I don't know, just you've probably run into Christians that, God love them, brother, sister, but they're just not doing it. It's not making any sense. There's cultural overlays that are blocking. I think church music, a lot of church music, just so bad. And I think frankly we're moving into a post-religious phase of Christianity. I think what Dietrich Bonhoeffer wanted us to explore, which was religionless Christianity, I think there's a whole generation happening right now, and they're not unspiritual, they're not undisciplined, they're not uninterested in history, they're just uninterested in the way church has been done for the last 500 years. It's just not happening. So they're abandoning. It's post-religious. Anyway, so Mary Carr and the religion and the literature of conversion. I've selected poems from her corpus. from her first book of poems, second, third, and fourth. And I want to look at a few and think about them in terms of her life. And I mean, she's going to be talking tonight, and she's going to be, she can be pretty crazy and wild, or she can be, I don't know, we'll see how she is tonight. She is someone who has pushed through this whole thing and come out with on the B side. Any questions so far? I know that I'm kind of just flying here. Any questions about Kuhn or Sire? We're good? We're on track? Okay. First poem I want to look at is Courage. I'll read it. Courage. This much is clear. You have to be alone with grief, to walk each squeaky floorboard by yourself, to puzzle out what's brought that tightness to your throat, that salt, this pouring forth. There is no one you can call, no number. You have to be alone with this. And the feathered dancers who distract you, the spinning fans, the cinnamon flavor of apples, the cigarettes you smoked, these will do no good. The songs will make it worse. You have to be alone. Someone you loved is gone. Not dead, but step by step away from you. On purpose. No accident. Nothing misunderstood. The door was pulled tight. The one of many doors you face in this corridor. Your life. And not one will open, suddenly framing by a backlit friend. You have to take this bag of grief, each little betrayal, and pack it small. Roll it like bad wool into a ball, and with all your strength, your sinew, your tendons like bowstring, place it on your back and keep walking, however slowly, down the hall. The door was pulled tight. Here you are. The one of many doors you face in this corridor, your life, and not one will open suddenly framing by a backlit friend. Suddenly framing. I syntax it. Am I missing something? I want to take out by.
Or make it framed.
Yeah, suddenly framed by a backlit friend. There is a bleak picture. This is a worldview statement. Where we are, the door closed behind us, we woke up, we're in the corridor, there are doors. We're losing people left and right. Not by death, but by choice. Sometimes our own choice. And no matter what door we try, we will not encounter that friend ever again. There's nothing there. In fact, you can't open the doors. You just have to load your grief on your back and keep walking, however slowly. Closed universe. Okay, it's a closed, it's maybe a psychological universe, but it's getting at the larger universe, a way of seeing the world and doing this thing we call being human. I see this poem, and of course she's not writing with these categories in mind. These are artificial categories of analysis, and you may, being a literature person, perhaps you may say you're forcing this into something here that doesn't really, Mary Carr wouldn't agree with you on this one. But it certainly has resonance. It speaks to me of being locked into one way of seeing the world. Closed universe, there are doors, but they don't open to anywhere, don't open to anyone. This is all we get, this corridor, these doors. Keep walking. Vampire is a great poem too, but we're not going to read it. Rather, we're going to look at My New Diet. A guy in the bar where I drink every night told me a great lie about pygmies. How they eat just once a year when the rains come. And then it's anything in sight. It was a wet night, so we drank to the pygmies on their hunt. lifted mugs to a speared board, dancing in jungle sun. A happy story ending with a belch, the village asleep beneath palms, and then the waitress tipping the stools up on the bar. Some nights you have to take what you hear for fact. Some nights you have to believe a man just because he needs to be believed. I swung open the door to my taxi and took him home. I slithered out of my black dress like a python while the rain banged its brains out on the window, the ritual thump of zebra drums until the world turned black and white. No photographs were taken, but I felt captured when I woke alone at dawn. I put my finger down my throat to return everything false I ever swallowed, return to the pure feeling I had as a girl, thumbing through National Geographic on Sunday morning, hungry for another place, and dying to make something of myself, however small. What do you think? Where is this? What's happening here?
Is this the post-conversion poem?
No. Yes, it was written just last week.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, she pretty famously, I mean, everybody who knows Mary Carr knows that she drank a lot, and she was promiscuous and enjoyed herself in that, apparently.
Or not, as the case may be.
But where does this poem leave us?
She's longing for innocence in Greece.
Yeah.
The restore.
Something, however small. Yeah. And again, it's. I look at this as sort of an anomaly. In her confident worldview, she called herself. Perhaps you remember this from reading. An undiluted agnostic. And she uses her terms, and she's smart, she knows agnostic is you can't know. It's impossible to know. So why pretend like we do know or can know? Undiluted agnosticism. So here she is in that, and yet in the midst of her headlong parade into whatever, there's this haunting. There's this haunting of what it felt like to be a little girl before all the crap, before becoming an adult and taking responsibility for, yeah.
I was going to say something, I mean, comparing some of her post-conversion poetry, and she's got a poem where she, I think at the end she says, you know, take this and eat it.
Yeah.
And she's talking about meat and more things going on there, but in this poem, which I haven't read yet, I haven't read before, I just thought it was interesting how she put her finger down my throat. So that's, she's eating herself. She's longing for some sort of body.
She's vomiting.
She's exiting out.
Yeah, it's sort of both ends
exactly.
In one gesture. Yeah.
So it's the idea of what she's accepting in one way, her pre-conversion and post-conversion in terms of body.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you could say it's sort of a anticipatory moment.
Yeah.
I kind of like the idea, you know, on the spectrum that there's, at the same time there's a conversion to something else, there's a deconversion from something, and I think that the, you know, that this poem is the beginnings of, you know, we sort of get pulled and pushed at the same time towards a new. Mm-hmm. And this is a little bit like the, I know it's a cliche analogy, but you know, at the end of The Graduate, you know, when he finally leaves and he's going on this bus and there's this famous, which won the Oscar, Dustin Hoffman has this face where it's finally like, oh shit, you know, like what have I actually done, you know, and there's this idea that I think in this poem that there's a sense in which this would be, you know, I would love to know how it was received by her friends and when it was written, because I wonder if they said, well, it's not that bad. You know, like, it wasn't like, maybe it wasn't your finest night. But you know, in the same way that people, you know, in whatever they're being deconverted from, their friends find that destabilizing also and say, well, you know, hey, you know, don't leave New York. It's not that bad. You know, don't leave our church. Don't leave our club, whatever it may be.
Well, we do know that this poem comes from a book that was published when she was 33.
Wow.
She was born in 55, or 32, 33. Isn't that right? Did I do my math right? She was converted in 1996, so this was well before conversion. And though a cradle Catholic, she does admit that her family was adamantly anti-religious.
It's just so heartbreaking because you wonder how many more unwritten poems that basically, you know, unwritten life poems took place before it was realized that this may be something to be converted from.
Well, I think one of the wonderful things about studying whether the literature or the art of conversion is that their pre-conversion poems are part of the story. And if they've written themselves out to Christ, they have grace to write themselves out beyond him, you know, in him. We see the story of transformation in the context of very, very moving, powerful images. Yeah, she knows, she knows in her body that some kind of purgation is necessary, some return to, but not obviously return to that childhood, but something clean and good and right. There's that hunger in spite of her commitment to living in the freedom of her current worldview. It's an anomaly. That's a gnawing, aching anomaly in someone who sees the world one way and is converted. I mean, is undiluted in her commitment to that worldview. Annoying, this longing for innocence. Ew, there is no such thing. And yet, she writes powerfully about it. Letter from an airplane. Carries over onto the next page. Years ago, I flew away from you. I had faith. It flickers now like a star. Where are you? You ask on a Christmas card. In seat 3D, in midnight air, wearing a 14-karat sacred heart, your gift the year I got remote. And the urge to be holy, to write the truth, becomes a joke. I am Mary who gives birth to deep regret in airplanes. On postcards signed, somebody help me. That's right, that's what it is. I figured that out before. When I saw it again, I thought it was French. Is it enough? The star is still plastered to the glass. I drink too much. I'm scared I've gone too far. If I bail out now over this small Montana town, where you live with your dumb wife, would you rush out? Or buckle yourself in, click out the light. Regard each parachute as a giant flake of snow, some natural mistake, like belief in God, in love, how I thought I could live alone. Everything looks up, I write, as snow drifts down. I thought we'd both be dead by now. On the wing, a blue light dims, wheels scrape ground, and I could weep ice cubes for all the thoughts that count. Please think we're angels hung on separate trees, dangling in our dark selves, houses lit by candles, drippy stars. You unlatch paradise. You learn to sleep through days, standing like a beast. Sleep while you're turning pages or crying out from love. You sleep and sleep. One day, you wake up dead. Strange hands raise you from your bed. The zippers, jagged teeth, interlock before your shining eyes. Small world. I hope you realize that I just read the ending to a different poem. Sorry, I got excited about that at the other page. It does end with drippy stars. But I think let's I'm going to talk to her tonight and suggest that she change this. Wow, go back to 49. I forgot to check the page. Again, here, is she protesting too much? Or you know, is it the joke? This urge to be holy, to write the truth, becomes a joke? Some natural mistake, like belief in God, in love, how I thought I could live alone?
It just to me that there's a progression in terms of her vision of herself as being singular and isolated. And in the second poem, she was attempting to relate, of course, by normal human standard, that's not a relationship that
the one
has any legs. Yeah. And now she's talking about some kind of relationship that was, but it's more profound and more developed in the second one, and it's quite a progression from the first.
Mm-hmm. And yet, it's that relationship.
Oh, she hasn't arrived.
Is sort of over.
Yeah, exactly.
Still going. Please think we're angels hung on separate trees, dangling in our dark selves, mm-hmm. houses lit by candles, drippy stars. I mean, even the light is momentary. I don't know if she's going to be reading any of your poetry tonight. I think she's just going to be talking about being Mary Carr. And that's fine. I hope she reads some of her poems, or one anyway. Getting ready for the garbage man. All alleys end here tonight. Your plastic bags, obese with carcasses and coffee grounds. All Sunday's helpings gone rot. You clatter softly. A fine sleet pellets your hide slippers. Your face steams gray in the vapors. Looking up into the bowl of night, you miss the intricate machine Galileo sketched. His planet's sturdy bearings in their chutes. Yours only lurch. The shining cars sleep in dank garages. Children sleep, hugging terrified bears. Only your mind rambles loose in this its chamber, which lacks any splendor. Even the squat garbage cans glimmer more than you. Armored sentries, dumb and waiting for dawn as ordered. If some of the poems we've read so far sort of have a bleak view of the universe, this sort of gets at the identity question. Who am I? What am I? She's not, at this point, she's obviously not interested in fooling herself with some doctrine of the nobility of human beings. And of course, perhaps she's also dealing with how she has treated herself. Who knows? Nothing's changing here, folks. We're looking at, you know, our first two volumes. It's if we're lucky, we'll run into an anomaly. Aha! Poem for Thomas Lux. Interesting that this poem for Thomas Lux, that his last name should be Light, you know, the Latin word for light. But Thomas Lux is a pretty cool poet. And here we are. She's in the middle of I think we're finally in her second volume, The Devil's Tour, and published in 1993. I can't read. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just 3 years before her conversion. And she's talking, this is the agnostic, talking to the unknowable. Which is great. It's like Khrushchev once said famously, God knows I'm an atheist. You know, this is like small but urgent request to the unknowable. Whatever small nugget of kindness we carry, that shy opal eye picture buried deep in gray folds of a cortex evolved to flinch at fire and whittle sharp sticks when beasts stalk too close. Whatever prompts bereaved widows to offer you coffee, then the guest book, and parched sailors adrift to share the day's thimble of water, the mothers to lift the most bent and broken children with joy and glad for the work of it, whatever iota of caring has survived the millennia's hardships, ice age and terror, and the simple tedium of walking upright. Maybe it's no bigger now than a seed in a fig. Tonight, I call for it. Call with my dry mouth from this cold room clouded by my being alive on a planet whose true gravity eludes me. Let that pinprick of light multiply in the sky's nightly leather and in the pupil of each eye. Let me seek it in the large crazed creatures whose shadows I fear most, in myself, for instance. Kneeling, I poke at this ash heap hearth in hope of some faint imagining, grateful for that. I wish Christians could pray this truly. You know? Anyway. Here again, we run into anomalies. She's experienced these nuggets of kindness, these iotas of caring, these pinpricks of light. She's saying, okay, I see these anomalies, like the longing for innocence or for purity. Caring does exist. This is driving me crazy. I don't know what I don't know, but would you please make these things happen more in our world? We need this in our world, and we need this in myself. And it's fabulous that the way she goes right after it, let me seek it. You know, she's not saying, I'm going to seek you, O God, and you only shall I seek. She says, I'm going to seek whatever this thing I don't know. I'm going to seek it in the large crazed creatures whose shadow I fear most. Perhaps the shadow of God. But even so, the nightmare creatures, she says, in myself, the things that are the most terrifying in herself, she's going to turn and face those things. Because she believes that in facing those creatures, perhaps there will be light. And of course, it's a way of self-caring as well. I mean, you are never going to get better unless you face what's messed, what's all askew and sick, as we heard up above. I'm fine. No, I'm fine. Really, I'm healthy. I'm just barely out of my 50s. I'm still young. And I'm good. Hope you are too. Be warm. Be well. Later. That's not her strategy. And maybe, I mean, this might be is this a gift of God to her? To be able to turn in all of her brazenness. Now she's going to do the most crazy thing of all. She's going to turn and face her greatest fears. In the hope that in that action, maybe she will see more light. Maybe she will come to greater kindness, greater caring. It's the only way she knows. Reading a little bit of her prose, she does say that she was horribly self-obsessed. She knew she was going to die, we all do, and she just was focused on that. And reading this stuff carefully, when you read through her whole bunch of work, I started to get really down. It teased out all the fears of death that I have, all the anxieties about sickness and meaninglessness, a wasted life, It's really great. All of the things I fear. The next anomaly, and the biggest anomaly in her life, and really the anomaly that tricked her into, perhaps even tricked her into conversion. Soft mask. On the ultrasound screen, my child curled in his own fluid orbit, less real than any high school textbook tadpole used to symbolize birth, till the nurse placed a white arrow on his heart flicker, a quick needle of light. Tonight, his face blooms in my window before trees stripped bare, a moon hung full and red. That soft mask, not yet hardened in autumn wind, would hold a thumbprint if I touched him. I hesitate to touch him. He's not yet felt the burden of a hand, nor tasted air, nor wobbled toward some blade-like gaze. His mouth smudged against the clear silk that envelops him, webbed hands that reach and retreat as a cat tests water. Or like Narcissus, or the great wandering Madonnas, or any beast lost in another, the demon who kneels to feed at some lily throat. His pulse first matching, then at odds with mine, that small arrow seeming to tremble as if striking something true. The next poem we're going to read, don't go there yet, is in fact, boom, it is one of her first conversion poems. But this poem, to me, is critical in understanding her development as an artist. It was life that that disturbed her. It was new life that disturbed her. It was just completely undid her confidence in her old way of seeing the universe, though she clung to it until he was old enough to say, "Mommy, I want to go to church." And perhaps you know the rest of the story. She went to church, sat in the back row, did crossword puzzles, anything but pay attention, and then found herself being stunned by the dance that she saw going on, with people speaking and singing and kneeling and rising and no irony and all heartfelt longing, all that stuff that she... but it was the son that got her there. She never would have gotten to church if her son had not said, "I want to go to church, I hear God lives there." Something like that. "I want to see if God's there." So this poem, to me, is psychologically, spiritually, whatever, it's a moment when all the anomalies kind of come together in a persuasive form. And that form is inside her body, and she's looking at it by way of the ultrasound and the picture. And this is the beginning. This is, again, her thing with her fingers, she knew it in her body. And so she had to physically enact the purging, mimicking the behavior of the night before. Right? And then releasing all that crap. Here again, she recognizes it in her body, this thing that was happening called a son. And then the grand miracle. And I think it would be fun to read that each of us take a stanza. And we'll just go around the room. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'll do the title. The Grand Miracle.
Jesus wound up with his body nailed to a tree, a torment he practically begged for, or at least did nothing to stop. Pilate.
Watch the crowd go face down and weary. Sign the order. So centurion laid Jesus flat.
On a long beam, arms run along this crosspiece. In each palm a long spike was centered, a stone chosen to drive it. Skin.
Tears. The bones start to split. Once the cross got propped up, The body hung heavy, a carcass.
Incarnate, the Latin poets say, in meat. The breastbone, a ship's prow. At the end, the man cried out. As men cry, tears that fill the eyes grow dark, drop and by drop. One cries out. On the third day,
the stone rolled to reveal no corpse. History is rife with such hoaxes. Look at Herodotus.
As to whether he multiplied loaves and fishes, that's common enough. Poke seed corn in a hole and see if more corn
doesn't grow. To fish in a pond make more fishes. The altar of reason supports such extravagance. I don't even know
how electricity works. Put trust in light switches, and the prospect of love cheers me up as gospel.
But some creator might strap on an animal mask to deliver our path between birth and ignominious death. Now that
makes me less lonely. In the rising up, the end into glory. The white circle of bread on the meat of each tongue that God
might enter us. For 2,000 near years, my tribe has lined up at various altars. So dumbly I open this mouth for bread and song.
Is it her best poem? No. Is it one of the most important poems? I think so. And this is where sometimes, again, best and most important don't always come together. It's like this is a poem that starts kind of predictably, and in that respect, it's not great. I mean, you've read, we just read a series of her poems in which you didn't know what she was going to do from line to line, stanza to stanza. And now all of a sudden, because we know the story, this doesn't surprise us until she makes that turn. As to whether he multiplied, and it suddenly gets peculiar. And we begin to get a sense of Mary Carr wrestling with the gospel. Not just someone, person A, trying to figure out how to paraphrase the gospel, but we get a real person coming in to that new world, that new way of seeing, and beginning to try to find language for it. For me, the word, the language, the three words that sort of raise the hairs on the back of my head is, at the end, the man cried out, as men cry. Those three words, as men cry. That speaks to me of the incarnation. That whole business that Irenaeus talked about of recapitulation, that which he has not assumed, he cannot redeem. And here he is, he's assuming human grief. He is crying as men cry, with men, bearing in himself all the sin and grief and trial and trouble. And because of that, now we have someone who can empathize with us in our weakness and who can help us, yeah.
That's great. I also appreciate, like, almost the sacramentology at the end there makes me less lonely, and that rising up at the end into glory, but she takes that, like, glory and puts it almost, like, back into an ordinary meme, you know, in bread, and the meat on the tongue.
It's not the meat on the tongue, it's the meat that is the tongue.
Yeah.
There are a few things that she repeat. They're like motifs in her writing. One is spiders. Mm-hmm. She's really freaked by spiders, and they show up in really cool places. And also, she is upfront about bodies. It's meat. I mean, it's just, this is the meat. If you've seen any of... I won't go. I was thinking of some paintings that... by, I think it's Bruce Herrmann. Any of you know his work, Bruce Herrmann's work? He has a whole series of paintings about Jesus, life of Jesus, and you're just stunned by his sense of the body as meat. I mean, really, he draws it like it's a beef thing that's been stripped of its hide, and you can see the muscle and the fat, and it's pretty powerful. The last two poems. Let me see if I did that right. Chosen Blindness is the longest of the poems. I recommend it heartily. It's really the story of how it all happened for her coming to faith. It's sort of it's a testimony of sorts, and I commend it to you. But I want to look finally at two prayers. We looked at that prayer to the unknown. I want to finish with two prayers. At the sound of the gunshot, leave a message. In this case, it is for Franz Wright. I don't know if you're familiar with the poet Franz Wright. He won the Pulitzer for a little book of poems called Walking to Martha's Vineyard. He's in the same way that Mary Carr is kind of famously a converted person, he is famously suicidal and just angry. He is so angry. He's a believer. But he's one of the angriest people on the planet, and he's horribly suicidal. His father committed suicide, James Wright, famous poet, and Franz is haunted. And he gets into horrible arguments with people. Anyway, at the sound of the gunshot, leave a message. That's what my friend spoke into his grim machine the winter he first went mad. As we both did in our 30s, with still no hope of revenue, gravely inking our poems on pages held fast by gyres the color of lead. Godless, our minds did monster us, left us bobbing as in a swamp until we sank. His eyes were burn holes in a swollen face. His breath was a venom he drank deep of. He called his own tongue a scar. This poet, who can crowbar open the most sealed heart, make ash flower, and the cocked shotgun's double zero mouths, whose pellets had exploded star holes into plaster and porcelain and not a few locked doors, never touched my friend's throat. Praise him, whose earth is green. Unknown to him, capital H, coming to know. And just, again, she's dealing with a suicidal, manic, crazy friend who writes phenomenal poems. There's no judgment. There's just deep empathy. We went mad. It's been a hell of a life for both of us. And thank God you're not dead yet. Thank God you haven't pulled that stinking trigger. It's still a question. He's still alive, living in Greater Boston area. He still goes on manic rants. He's kind of someone that if you invite him to read at your festival, you don't know what you're going to get. I think he's been pretty stable for a while, but I don't know. He's nobody I know, really. Just his reputation. But I love that poem. I mean, yeah, that poem, which is a prayer. And Mary Oliver says that poems and prayers come from the same place. She's come to believe that. Lastly, for a dying tomcat who's relinquished his former hissing and predatory nature. I remember the long orange carp you once scooped from the neighbor's pond, bounding beyond her swung broom across summer lawns to lay the fish on my stoop. Thanks for that. I'm not one to whom offerings often get made. You let me feel how Christ might when I kneel, weeping in the dark over the usual maladies, love and its lack. Only in tears do I speak directly to him and with such conviction. And only once you grew frail, did you finally slacken into me, dozing against my ribs like a child. You gave up the predatory flinch that snapped the necks of so many birds and slow-moving rodents. Now your once powerful jaw is malformed by black malignancies. It hurts to eat. So you surrender in the way I pray for. Lord, before my own death, let me learn from this animal's deep release into my arms. Let me cease to fear the embrace that seeks to still me. I mean, we're just just we're looking at someone who has, who was locked up in her own death and her own misery and her own alcoholism and her own drives, libido, and all of a sudden she's praying for her suicidal friend, and she's learning from her cat about what it means to be alive, not dying, not fearful of death, but at the end, let me cease to fear the embrace that seeks to still me. Ah, just, this is a better poem than the Jesus poem. And also, I love cats. So I had to include that. I have a cat. Any questions? Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Buy her books. I think one of them is for sale upstairs. It's the most recent, Sinner's Welcome. And there's this two other books that are absolutely fabulous as well, next to hers. Might be mine. David told me to plug my book, so look them over anyway. If there are no questions, I guess we're done.